dark. It was kind of hard for me. And I remember it was dusty, and I thought, oh my gosh, it almost feels like, is this, I don't know, it's just, you know, like kukui, scary, you know, because it was so quiet, peaceful. And I was amazed that so many people could be there, and it could be so quiet, so disciplined. And I just wanted to mention that because it has stuck in my head. Mm-hmm. When I pass through there and I see the room, and I remember, oh, that, and I could hear that man and that woman as I passed, and they were like, in this little, who are they, and what were they saying? And that, you know, kind of like that voice that you hear when you're real young and you fall asleep and your parents are in the next room talking, and then, you know, now they're talking about something real serious, and it's, you know, this kind of conversation, it kind of puts you to sleep. It was that kind of, you know, conversation going up. It was real quiet.
I think we're just about ready to move on to take comments and questions from the audience. And, you've been very attentive and very patient. Thank you.
I think there's one thing.
Go ahead.
I want to say.
Sure.
This fast gave Caesar the moral authority to take positions later on. And the one thing I think we ought to think about is the fact that I know there are a lot of historians poking around, okay? Now, later in the 70s, there were some internal problems with the union, and Caesar recorded these meetings, so there they are. Nobody was around to record what he said when that fast was announced. To me, more importantly, nobody was in the field office the day that Juan got shot on the picket line. And I want to read you something here that really, to me, is very important. Because in 1973, when we lost the contracts, there were Teamster goons floating around, first in Coachella and then in Kern County. And there were sheriff's deputies pounding on people. And Naji Daifula was hit over the head with a flashlight and killed. Juan de la Cruz was shot dead on the picket line. And I was in the field office with Caesar that day, and I felt, I know what I felt myself, I still feel it, that anger, because you knew damn well that there would be no justice, that Al Leddy, the district attorney of Kern County, would not get a conviction, which he did not, that there would be no justice in terms of the sheriff's deputy that clubbed Naji Daifula. It was ruled an accidental death. And here we have a statement from Al Leddy. He's the district attorney, okay? And I'll tell you why I think this is important. This is right after Naji's murdered. Kern County District Attorney Al Leddy tells the press, this is on August 17th, 1973, that Naji Daifula, quote, over whom Chavez is to spend 3 days praying and fasting, had been working Thursday for the Kovacovich Ranch and told the ranch that he was a Teamster spy. Well, what is a district attorney doing peddling grower propaganda? Now, Caesar comments a few pages before that in Levy's book that Juan Hernandez had his skull fractured. He knew there were Teamster goons, but he said Leddy had abdicated his responsibility. It was open season on farm workers in Kern County. Why is that important? Because not only do you feel the anger, I felt anger, I wanted to do something myself. But you also felt a double layer of anger because you knew that the law enforcement mechanism was not going to do its job. So ironically, what we had here is Caesar in the field office redirecting that anger. We're going to make black flags. We're going to have a candlelight vigil. We're going to have a march. He just channeled all that anger into a nonviolent response, in effect doing what the very law enforcement officers who were mocking him, like Leddy, were incapable of doing. And how was Caesar able to do that? The fast enabled him to do that. That's why, in my own opinion, it's the defining moment in the history of this union. I don't think there's anything more important than that fast and what flowed from it. And I just hope, you know, there's an English writer named Thomas Carlyle who talks about historians being in a little boat floating on a sea of facts. And they dip their bucket into that sea of facts. And I just hope that somebody can dip their bucket into this particular part of the sea, because I think it's the most important part. I just wanted to say that and get that off my chest.
And one thing about that I want to mention, to add to what Jerry said, is that Caesar said that when you use violence, it's because you can no longer, you don't know how to organize. You have lost your ability to be a creative organizer. So it would have been a real easy thing for, you know, what Caesar did was showing us that he's being very creative, you know, and he's organizing. And that's how he taught us, you know, and I think that's why our union has survived, because we've been through hell and back. And, you know, we have to continue organizing, and we have to continue being very creative at what we do. And I think Caesar left us a great legacy. And, you know, maybe there were people later on that, you know, I don't know, I've been accused of, oh, you know, she a yes person, anything Caesar wanted, she would do, whatever. And not that I'm anything great, but, you know, it's said about me. But I'll tell you what, when somebody shakes your hand and they give you your word, you know that that's a person that means it's a contract. And you know what? Caesar shook my hand. And he didn't grab it and shake it like that, you know, physically, but you know, he did it in my heart. He gave his word. He was gonna build a union, and we were all there. We were gonna, you know, he was our leader, I didn't follow. I don't think, you know, we got to a point that fast. Caesar proved to us. He proved to us, and he showed us, and that he was doing this because it was going to be for the good of the union. It was going to be to take us from where we were and just bring us to a place where we had never been. And he formed the union, and he did that. And nonviolence was a very big part of that. I don't know. I can't express it really well, but I hope you understand what I'm trying to say, that Caesar proved it, proved himself, and he didn't have to, but he did, you know, to help us with our union, to build our union.
Esther, you have anything to add? Chris, anything to add?
Let's open it up.
Let's open up. We are going to open it up. I just want to, since Jerry got to read, I get to read. Just listen to this for a minute. What were the results of Caesar's commitment to nonviolence? Correct me if I am mistaken, but during the 31-year period of his movement, not a single grower or family member was killed or injured. Their house burned or automobile vandalized. Nor any agribusiness supervisor, nor any local law enforcement officer, nor any farm labor contractor. No farm worker, striker, or organizer was ever convicted of doing bodily harm to a strikebreaker. Only one farm worker organizer was ever convicted of causing property damage. During this 31-year period, there were hundreds of strikes and thousands of strike breakers and striking farm workers, an amazing tribute to the leadership of Caesar Chavez. Okay, we will open it up for questions or comment, and I'll serve as a moderator. So if you'd give your name, please, and that way it'll be captured on the recording, and it'll be published on the website. Yes, sir.
My name is Benanza Ona, and my question is in a way related but unrelated. Because of your historical perspective and knowledge, what was your personal reaction, the four of you, to the, shall we say, the resistance or the efforts of the BC League and of the Armenian community to resist the unionization of farm workers?
Well, does anyone want to take a... the Nisei League and the...
And the BC,
and the Armenian.
And the Armenian. Well, first of all, in the maybe I'm focused now on 1968.
Right.
And I'm focused on 33 growers and Southern Pacific Railroad and a 300-mile strike zone, 300-square-mile strike zone. These two groups you mentioned were not on my radar screen at that particular time.
That's fair.
You know?
And I don't think they should be isolated out. All of agribusiness wanted to destroy us, not just any particular group of growers. They didn't want to have a union to deal with.
But in the church fight that was going on from 65 to, say, 68, the Nisei Farmers League was the most effective of our opponents because they symbolically represented... a minority group that had been put in concentration camps, and they tended to represent farmers with smaller acreage. So for church people who were arguing against our involvement, it was always, what about the poor small farmers? What about the poor small farmers? And the Nisei Farmers League did the best job of representing that point of view.
I just want to indicate that, you know, that there were two examples of real severe violence during that year of 68. Martin Luther King on April 4th, that same year, and obviously Bobby Kennedy in June of that year. It was a tumultuous year of 68. When we had, even in San Francisco, though, I was obviously so far away, I couldn't make a trip every day down to Lino. In fact, I took up flying because I couldn't stand the drive to Lino. Caesar signed my first flight book when I flew into Lino. But anyway, that was, the thing that maintained that during that time was a tremendous example. You know, I just feel that was
I
and it was very important, but remember, this was during the Lenten season, and a tradition of the Catholic Church fasting and so on was something understood by us. I think we knew what Caesar was really doing.
Steve?
I'm Steve Petty. I'm one of those historians kicking around. Monsignor Boyle, in some sense, asked the question I wanted to ask. It seems to me that this is so impressive and important that this happens in 1968. The Tet Offensive had started in late January. You know, the United States is really at a very, very violent moment. Civil rights has gone to a point in which there's a great attention paid to black men with guns. Tijerina, Corky Gonzalez, Jose Angel Gutierrez, and others are talking about a very different path towards liberation, one that involves armed resistance first and foremost, and sovereignty and self-determination gained through arms. And it's just so impressive. It continues, this is more of a comment than a question, but it continues to be so impressive to me that in the very high season of this, the fast happens, and that it happens, starts quietly, but it ends in an enormous moment in Memorial Park, a moment in which the Caesar's statement is read, I think in Spanish by Julio Hernandez and in English by Jim Drake, saying, to be a man is to suffer for others. God help us to be men. I think Chris actually helped write that statement. And to that notion of manhood as being one based in suffering and in sacrifice, as opposed to one being based in forceful resistance, I think is an amazing thing. So much so that Tijerina, as I understand it, was in the park that day. And he announced
Jim
his support for China
the whole thing.
And for the union. Mm-hmm. And it just seems to me like an enormous moment of political jujitsu almost, in which the forces that are being pushed on to the Union under Chavez are so radically taken on, and those forces become amazingly overwhelmed by this act of fasting. So it's really more a comment than a question, but it's one that's intended to remind us of what it meant in the spring of 68 to be doing this.
Steve, when you're looking at this part of the story, in addition to the restraint that people showed to the two murders, think about this. 3,500 people went to jail in 1973, nonviolently, in good spirits. You can see it on Fighting for Our Lives. How did that happen? Nothing like that has ever happened in labor history, in the history of this country. Why did that happen? That would not have happened but for this fast.
Another important movement at that time, too, that struck out as a violent one was the Black Panthers. They came up during that particular era. And though some of us tried to more or less emphasize the good things they were doing, we certainly were very, very upset about their stand of violence. Well, then people understood why they were doing it, huh? I mean, they were reacting to the brutality of the Oakland Police Department.
Yep. Your name, please?
I'm Teresa de la Rosa. When you talk about the impact that Caesar's fast had, I was a senior in college in Mexico City, and I remember very clearly how much of an impact. We were following Caesar's activities because in Mexico at the time, being a union organized, unions, were not really unions for the people. They were in they had three-part contracts with the Mexican government and the company. So for us, students in Mexico City, after what we had got in 1968, and we learned about what Caesar was going through, it was something that really impacted us as students, hoping that there was hope for the workers in the world. It was such an impact that it made such an impact to many of us at the university that we decided to come to the United States with a delegation to meet with leaders of the Southwest. And for us, and for me in particular, there was a determining, fact or activity in my life to the extent that I decided to stay in the United States. And my objective, and I have expressed this to Paul, was to write a book about Cesar Chavez. Eventually, in 1978, I had the privilege to work for him. But I think he really made an impact throughout the world and in Mexico. We really felt that he had given us hope. And I think to this day, he continues to give us hope through his activities.
Thank you. Yes?
Sal Alvarez. I visited with Caesar on the 22nd day, and I did because, and he actually came out of the room and was in his rocking chair and sucking on ice. And I was there because the year before I had gotten hired by the Bishop's Committee for the Spanish Speaking that was based out of San Antonio, Texas, with Archbishop Lucy. And Monsignor Roger Mahoney from Fresno's Catholic Charities and Monsignor Jerry Cox and a couple of other people identified me as the person to direct that office. Washington, Oregon, California. And we met with Caesar, Monsignor Cox and I met with Caesar and he says, I need a priest. So we went to the Franciscan Order and part of that history is that Mark Dave ended up being placed there after we had a conversation with Bishop Manning. Well, I had been working with Bishop Donahue in Stockton, who had a PhD in labor economics, as you all know, and was one of those bishops that was more progressive. And we were doing some organizing in that diocese, and Caesar had come to Stockton to a meeting of the Bishop's Committee that I was directing. And he also had gone to Fresno, and we have pictures of him and he was actually working to get church support particularly from the Cursillo movement that he was a part of. He had made his Cursillo in Stockton. Father Reynaldo Flores was the director of that in 62. And that's where he made the commitment. Last night, Richard Chavez was talking about how that was the transformation for Caesar, that Cursillo. And so Caesar had made an agreement with me that he was going to go to Fresno, but he landed up on the fast. And so I come see him, and he gives me a written statement in handwriting on the church and the farm worker movement, where he says, we don't want charity. We want the spiritual and economic power of the church behind us. And we had, about 300 of us had picketed in San Francisco the U.S. Catholic Conference. So there had been pressure, and basically within the Catholic Church, and Monsignor Boyle here comes in from the Commission on Social Justice in San Francisco. Was one of the few that came into the valley. And so Caesar, I think what you had said about the religiosity, his, you know, the people, the faith of the people, that he felt very strongly about his faith, to the extent that at one point he says, I want to start a religious order. And I know that there was tension in the Union over that issue. That Caesar actually had talked about establishing a religious order similar to what St. Francis had done. And we had conversations about that. And what Jerry said about that there had been some tension over, you know, those that saw it as strictly a labor movement and this religious stuff mixing in there and all this other stuff, that was part of the tension of what was going on. And I appreciate the comments that have been made with respect to that.
Paul?
I have a question. You know, you'd asked earlier about when people had found out about the fast. I'm curious when people found out that the fast was going to come to an end, and then maybe what happened on March 10th.
Well, I think maybe I found out first when the fast was going to end, because I became very upset with Caesar, because you have to remember that we were friends. So it wasn't, you know, I mean, sure, he was my boss, et cetera, but we were friends. And I just put a lot of pressure on him as the days went by to say, look, it's gone far enough, and it's going to hurt you, and therefore it's going to hurt all of us. But you know your father. I mean, he's very stubborn. He knows what he's doing, you know, sticks with it. But one time he said to me, Leroy, you can't get the people until Sunday.
Until what?
Until Sunday. You can't get the people till Sunday. So I went out and said, it's going to end on Sunday. I mean, and by damned it did. And we got the people. I mean, look, there might be other...
We got Bobby Kennedy, too, probably because it was a Sunday.
Yeah. No, I mean, Cesar Chavez was constantly thinking in organizational terms and impact and bringing people together.
Caesar also said that they asked him about when he fasted, and he said that was the first vacation he had in a long time. That's the kind of vacation I want to take.
Okay, in the back.
Funny.
My name is Ed Rose, from the Northeast San Fernando Valley. In 68, I was in a group called Valley Friends of the Farm Workers, and in March we went to visit Caesar right after the fast, and he was in the paint house recovering. I remember being kind of apprehensive about going in because this is really a great man. What do we talk about? But as soon as I met him, the way his charm, his charisma was, you know, all those kinds of fears evaporated. And I remember seeing this smaller than I really thought man laid in, I think it was like a hospital bed in his white pajamas. And I expected him to talk about, like, you know, the rotten growth. each other. It's kind of, it's been a thing that's stuck with me these past 40 years, and it's kind of directed me in the way I try to do things in my life, and also try to direct my children the way they the values that they have.
Artie?
Yeah, Arturo Rodriguez. You know, after 40 years, and this can come from any of you or several of you, but knowing what you know now and what transpired back then and organizationally how it was trying to be used, but also for many other reasons as well, what would you have done differently during those 25 days?
You mean hindsight?
Hindsight.
Yeah, because, yeah. Because during that, first of all, I don't think we knew what we were doing. We were just trying to do something. What would we do differently? What would we have done differently? Jerry? Chris,
you know, Artie, there was so much pressure on that you weren't thinking like tactically. You were just responding to this event. I'm not sure that any of us could have done anything differently. I mean, I knew my role. I needed to keep him out of jail. I didn't know what the judge was going to do. I saw what Marshall Gans was doing down there. I saw what Manuel Chavez was doing and Bustos and Cardenas and what Leroy was doing. Everybody was responding to an event, and it wasn't as if you sat down in a room and mapped it out on butcher paper. It was too real for that. I don't think there's a damn thing any of us could have done any differently, to tell you the truth, you know? There was a force at work here, Artie, that was unique.
Esther? Marissa?
I wanted to...
Your name, please.
I'm Marissa Roy. I'm originally from Bakersfield in Salino, and I live in Oakland. I was interested in if you could paint a picture for me where the Filipino farm workers were at the time of the fast. What were their feelings about the fast? Any kind of details?
Well, the Filipino farm worker that I had the closest relationship with over the years was Fred Abad. He was a real leader in the crews. And Fred Abad understood the importance of the fast. And Fred Abad also understood that there were some workers in the crews that he related to, you know, that would like to get a little rougher with the scabs, but Fred was reasonable enough to know that things like the union treasury and the commitment to nonviolence was important. So the only person I can speak to is really Fred, and he was positive.
Well, one of the things that struck me about your question is, I mean, I have seen so many photos because of the website, and therefore, you know, I see so many images. And around the fast and fast-related pictures, I always see Philip Veracruz right in the photo. Lariat Leong, right there.
And Andy Amuton.
I mean, they're like, it's their fast, too. So I don't think they had, I don't think there was a separateness about it. It was just, when you see the photos, when you take a look at the photos, and some of them are on exhibit next door, they're there.
And it was the same, you know, the Filipinos, it was like the Mexicanos. We got angry and we were used to, you know, standing up and, you know, defending ourselves, or, you know, we were very similar in that way. So, you know, the whole idea of nonviolence, it was something that all of us had to kind of stop and look at and start practicing and really internalize it, because one of the things that Caesar told us at that meeting was that you have to feel it in your heart. And that stuck with me, like, feel it in your heart. You know, it doesn't come from here, it comes from here, you know, and...
You know, one thing that Larry's initial reaction in Filipino Hall was, I think we should have a petition, all sign a petition that will be nonviolent, and then Caesar will eat. And Manuel got up and said, You just don't understand. You're dealing with a stubborn Indian here. God damn it, he's not going to eat. Get off the petition idea. And Larry's feeling was, you know, kind of like my initial reaction. You don't want this guy not eating. You're worried about him. But I think Leroy's right. Look at the pictures. There's proof there.
My name is Jaime Martinez. I'm from San Antonio, Texas.
Hey, viva Texas.
I come out of a local union, IUE. When I was in the factory back in 1968, we found out about Cesar Chavez in the past. And to us, to my union, we were 100% members in a right to work for less state in Texas. And we were organized in 1956. It was a very progressive militant organization, IUE Local 780. And I was a factory worker. I was a steward. And to us, the impact about a labor leader who, against tremendous odds, Cesar Chavez, fasting for nonviolence. And we were on strike in 64 for a 100-day strike. But to the impact it had on our union membership, we were one of the first to endorse Cesar Chavez within the AFL-CIO. And in my conversations with other labor leaders, especially the 1968 past, Cesar was very into the future. He was a visionary. He had, you know, distance in his eyes. When he went on that past, it was not labor unions that went on strike. A leader to go on a fast, and the teachings of Gandhi and Martin Luther King, to us, it was very dramatic. What did, in your opinion, when he went on that fast, what did you think about the fast?
Well, my first reaction is I thought it was great. Great, this is from a selfish point of view. There was a lot of tension in our union at that time. There was a lot of conflict. There was a lot of unhappiness with Caesar because there was no way that strike was going to be won on the picket line. No way. Everyone knew it. So how were we going to win? Well, it had to be the boycott. And the boycott takes time. A lot of time. But it's what made it happen. So there was a lot of tension that, like, maybe Caesar had lost it, or maybe he wasn't doing enough to win the strike in Delano, et cetera, et cetera. So I was thrilled because here's my friend, and he stood up and said, "This is it, and this is where I'm going, and if you're coming, fine, and if you're not, fine." Now, I also agree with Jerry that Caesar counted the votes before he did anything. But you know what I mean?
But you know, the question of time is really important. The moral authority that he had in 73, when people wanted to get retaliation, and rightly so, for those two deaths and all those beatings, knowing that there'd be no justice in Kern County, he had to convince people that there was time to win. They may be the tools of the growers here in Kern County, but when we go and argue in Sacramento for a law, they'll be our tools. When we go out on the boycott and tell our story, they're our tools. You know, a little time-related story about nonviolence has to do with Texas. In 1967, there was a strike in Texas. A little premature, Gil Padilla was there, and it was a melon strike. The Texas Rangers came in and beat the hell out of people, okay, in Rio Grande City. And there was a farm worker named Magdaleno Dimas who got his skull fractured. And Caesar asked me to go down there and see if we could gin up a federal lawsuit and stop the Rangers. We did gin up a federal lawsuit. And 6 years later, the United States Supreme Court said, you know what, the Rangers shouldn't have done that. And as I talked to the attorney from the UAW that helped us, Chris Dixie, said, these things take time. These things take time. We didn't have a lot of time. So we asked Caesar to come down. And he came down. The Rangers were still in town. He had a meeting with guys, and some of the guys he had a meeting were there were armed. They wanted revenge now. And Caesar said, just give me a little time. We'll teach these bastards the power of prayer. Okay? So we had Magdaleno Demas' women dressed in black. The Rangers come out of their damn hotel. They're praying for the Rangers' souls. And guess what? In 48 hours, Governor Connally had those bastards out of Rio Grande City. Now, you don't always... That's a short period of time. What Leroy's talking about, you know, different... It took time for the boycott to build. There was frustration over that winter. That's what Caesar was responding to. There were people who wanted to take mindless shortcuts. And, you know, eventually... You know, eventually there's a law that's passed in 75. Eventually you get some remedies, but you have to have the moral authority to convince people to be patient. If he hadn't gone on that fast, I'm telling you, I saw the anger in that field office in 1973. There would have been hell to pay if Caesar didn't redirect that energy into the funeral marches and the black flags and the candlesticks. I can't stress that enough.
Well, and Caesar, in a way, carried that fast with him in 1969 when he went out on that three-month tour of the boycott, because he had been in bed most of the year following the fast, and he was not physically in condition to go out on that tour. And he was in pain every day. Some days he was in so much pain that his mind didn't work the way it usually does. One of the best and funniest stories about that fast. We were in Newark, New Jersey, and Caesar had a joke he told at the beginning of every talk. And it was his favorite joke, and it was everybody's favorite joke, and it's simple, and I'll tell you. This woman is going shopping with her child, you know, and they're going past the grape counter, and the child tugs on the woman's skirt and says to her, "Mommy, Mommy, when can we get to have some of those boycotts?" And I might have left out that they were going past the grape counter, I don't know. So one night, Caesar gets up and he tells his joke, and when his talk is over, he sits down and he says, "Chris, nobody laughed. Why didn't anyone laugh?" He was so in so much pain that he had left out the key element of the story so that no one really understood the point of the story. But that's how much pain he had during that time. And every place we went, it was just visible in his face and visible in his back, and people knew it. People recognized that Caesar was still, you know, living the fast because of its impact on his body.
Remember, it was 68, and he would travel around his station wagon, and he had to lay down in the station wagon because his back hurt him so badly because of the fast.
I think we're going to have to... I'll take one more, and then because the recording session is just about finished.
Good.
I was just curious about the medical advice or attention or guidance that we have with somebody else that can be really damaging in such ways.
Yes, and he had excellent medical advice. Whether he took it or not is another story. But no, I mean the doctors, Dr. Jerry Lackner on the fast for fast for nonviolence, and Jerry was very attentive, did necessary testing and all, and as the fast wore on, Jerry came to me constantly and said, you know, Leroy, he said, "I'm very concerned. I want you to know that I'm medically very concerned about the negative consequences of this." He explained that to Caesar, too. Caesar knew what he was doing at that particular time. But I think we escaped, really, on that first fast. Some of the other fasts, I don't think he did as well, at least the one in Phoenix. I mean, he physically got ill. I mean, he had to be taken to the hospital. He physically got ill.
So, what about being diagnosed?
Oh, yeah.
Jumped on.
Yeah.
That's not how you
think. Well, there are a lot of stories. I'm not in a position to know which ones have been inflated over the years. I don't know. But Anyway, I think we should bring it to a halt here. I very much appreciate your kindly attention. Obviously, many of you are definitely interested in this. And I did bring some photographs that have never been made public. And I will leave them here. You cannot walk off with them, but I will leave them out here. For those of you who want to see these photographs of the 40 acres and the FAST that have never been made public, they're John Lewis photos. Unfortunately, we were so rushed for time, John did not have the time to print them himself, so I they're drugstore prints. So someday, they'll be first class. Yes?
You're right. I just have one question before you go.
All right.
And that is, you know, for the panel. And, you know, everybody had some role, had some experience with the FAST and saw the transformation of use of nonviolence and winning the fight. What lessons can you share from that lesson about us and what we're doing now in immigration, with education, in terms of the fight that's there with poor people? What would you see needs to happen? What would lessons would you draw from that for the future?
For me, the primary lesson, and it was kind of like one of those things you know in your head that sacrifice is a powerful thing, but then you see it in reality and the effect it has on other people. Slowly but surely, people get the sense that this is a genuine sacrifice by a human being for a cause that he believes in, and it pulls people closer. It just opens people's eyes and pulls them closer. And the same thing happened on the boycott, because people went from Delano out to these cities where, you know, they've never been outside the San Joaquin Valley. They didn't speak English that well. It was cold. It was in many ways completely different from their growing up experience. And yet they're out there telling the story of Delano grape strike and asking for support for the boycott. And people, I said, you know, who could say no? I mean, if you listened to that story and you knew what the story of that family was that had come to Cleveland or Detroit or Philadelphia or wherever, how could you say no to what they've asked you to do? And then they get you on the picket line, and then they get you, you know, sitting in the store, and they get you praying around the grape counter, and they get you in jail. And it's just like sacrifice pulls people in. And that was so obvious in the FAST. And it was an eye opener for me, because I saw what it did to the church supporters that I was working with.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there.
Yeah.
I'd like to just say that on behalf of the Chavez Foundation, I'd like to thank you, Leroy, for the time and effort you put in preparing for today's panel discussion. I want to thank Jerry for sharing his thoughts with us. I know that we had talked a little bit before the panel, and I think that some of the insights you bring are important, because it really does position importance of the decisions made 40 years ago and how it impacts us today. And Abby, I want to thank you for sharing. I knew you were kind of reluctant. You felt that a lot of the stories were personal, and I'm glad that you felt comfortable sharing the stories. And Esther, you know, I'm grateful that you
you're quiet
when you need to be quiet. No, seriously, Esther, I want to thank you for participating. I know that many times you're a little bit hesitant to do so, and when we asked you, you agreed to. So thank you very much. And Chris, thank you again for being here and giving us a hand with the ongoing work of the foundation. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you guys.